This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Science and Technology in the Service of the Poor, Dr. Walter Bradley.
Science and Technology in Service of the Poor, I think the first question I had is I was thinking, really, probably in the 4 months between when I accepted the job and I actually started, what could I possibly do to make a difference? And you look at the world with the tremendous needs that are out there, and you don't have to look very far to see that the world is a place with a lot of very desperately poor people. We had the opportunity in 1974 to go and live in Brazil for 6 months, where I was a visiting professor. And Brazil is actually fairly economically advanced compared to many of the so-called underdeveloped countries. But even there, the presence of poverty is just overwhelming, that it really just broke your heart to see how a lot of people had to live in cardboard houses with almost nothing to eat, children. 25,000 children in the town we lived in, panhandling on the street to make a living. And the question is, when you look at the way 2.7 billion people in the world today that live on $2 a day live, you have to say, and I might add, the vast majority of these are people who also have not been exposed to the gospel. You have to say, how can we go to these people and speak of God's love and care for them? And not be concerned about their physical well-being. How are people living in the conditions that these people lived in to imagine a God who loves and cares for me is a hard to imagine, given the actual life that they have at this point in time. And it seems to me the way that we can go and bring reality to that God loves you and cares about you is that God has sent us to help you and to try to minister to the physical as well as the spiritual needs that you have. I think in today's world, it's extremely hard to have a credible Christian testimony in many developing parts of the world that doesn't include a holistic approach to ministry. And interestingly enough, as we look at the way Jesus ministered, he blended together very beautifully ministry to physical and spiritual needs in many different ways. There are two Bible verses that have always been ones that were profound in their impact on my own thinking. One of these is in Matthew 25, you'll recognize Jesus said, when you fed, gave water to, when you clothed, you provided medical care, you invited into your home one of these poor brothers of mine, you did it for me. We often think at Christmas, what can we give Jesus for a Christmas present? And the answer is, well, find somebody who has real needs and give to them. That's the way of giving to Christ. From Luke chapter 12, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. And we can't read a verse like that living in the prosperity that we have in this country. Even as poor graduate students, I know a lot of you think, well, I'm poverty stricken, I'm part of that poor group. But most of us who are in graduate school are poor by choice temporarily. It's part of a longer plan of getting educated and having much better opportunities. And so our poverty is not like that of people who have no hope, who have no future. Now, when I thought of this verse, and during the 6 months that we lived in Brazil, we came away so concerned about the huge number of children there that lived on the streets and the work that World Vision did there that we actually adopted 5 children with their monthly program. And over the last 30 years, we've continued to have those 5 adopted children. Fortunately, not the same 5, because in 30 years, they should grow up, right? And they give you other ones over time. We have supported missionary orphanages in India and other kinds of projects. But I always thought of my response to the global poverty as really a response of writing a check. You know? Because these people were far away, the opportunities were far away, and I couldn't imagine what I could do from here except try to financially make an investment in work that was being done by people who were there. And it was only in the last 5 years that I've come to see that the work I can do as an engineer will maybe be worth 1,000 times as much as any check I could ever hope to write. That God can use the things that he has entrusted to me. When I thought of entrusted here, I was thinking of what? Money, right? But in fact, what God has given me that's far more valuable than that is gifts and talents and abilities and training and experience that equips me to do things that could potentially have a huge impact on the lives of these people. And so I've kind of come to see that entrusted is something that's much broader than what I previously thought of it as. Now, I'm going to share with you five examples of projects that are going on at Baylor right now. Four of these are ones I'm personally involved in, and one involves some friends of mine. But the idea here is not to share with you what you might do, but to share with you the wide variety of opportunities that are out there. When I started this 5 years ago, I had zero ideas about what I was going to do. And in fact, I had to scratch my head really hard and think, what could I possibly do that would make a difference? The summer before I started at Baylor, Ann and I were on business of some kind, I don't remember what, in Europe, and I read the Wall Street Journal Europe version of it, and they had a story in there about a Swiss engineer who had developed a machine that was being used in Mali that took all of the drudgery out of converting peanuts into peanut butter in a country where the women did not get to go to school because they had to stay home with their mothers, shell peanuts, and manually grind them and try to make what was their only potential source of income. And with this one machine, which could be afforded by one village, each village could have one, and one could process all the peanuts in the whole village every week in about 15 minutes per family, it dramatically transformed the whole culture of the country. And I thought, now, wow, that would really be cool if I could do something like that. That would be worth more than all the 150 papers I've written that probably haven't ever had the impact that one invention had. And it really made me begin to think and long to be able to do something of great significance like that, but doing as part of a kingdom-building exercise, not just as a humanitarian exercise. So here's some of the things that we're going to be looking at. Well, first idea that came to me, and it's an interesting story about how God guides and directs us. I won't have time to share with you all the details, although I'd be happy to share with you individually if you're curious. But I came to find out that coconuts are a very abundant renewable resource around the world that maps almost exactly with where there are lots of poor people, and that these coconuts, oddly enough, are almost all owned by poor coconut farmers. The problem is that they aren't worth anything. The value of coconuts today is extremely low, and the average coconut farmer makes about $500 per year. And so it occurred to me that, you know, you look at this, 120 coconuts per tree per year. That's a lot of biomass. And it ought to be worth something. Now, the main thing that they use coconuts for today is coconut oil. And even the value of that is only about 25% of what it was 20 years ago, because the farmers who grow vegetable oil type, or make vegetable oil basically, ran a smear campaign and persuaded everybody coconut oil is really bad for you, and so they took it out of popcorn and candies and everything. It turns out that it's actually quite good for you. But the people who were selling coconut oil had no money to find it. So even the one value, one item of value that they had has been drastically curtailed. This is an interesting map that shows by lightness of color, poverty, by darkness of color, per capita wealth, and between the blue lines, 20 degrees plus or minus from the equator, is where all the coconuts grow. And isn't it interesting that where coconuts grow is almost entirely the same area where there's lots of poverty? One country in this band, not desperately poor, in that same point. Everybody else has lots of poor people living in that region. 50 million coconuts per year could alleviate the poverty of families of coconut farmers in about 80 years. So our challenge about 3.5 years ago when we started on this was to say, what can we do to make coconuts worth more money? Now, I'm a material scientist, although I'm in mechanical engineering program. So when I think of things, I basically think of what are the material properties and what can we use it for? What can we use it for that could add tremendous value to different products, and what can we create big, huge markets for? So when you look at the coconut, there are basically four different constituent parts. We systematically set out to investigate each of those constituent parts and find out what are the properties and what are the unique characteristics of the different constituent parts and what might we be able to do with them. Okay, so what are some possibilities? Well, we found out that coconut pith, if you mill the husk, it looks like it's all fiber, but it's not. It's about half fiber, half coconut husk once it's dried out. It absorbs 10 times its weight in water, which gives it a wonderful potential for gardening applications. There are very few things that are organic. We first bought diapers. Okay, and we actually bought some diapers and tried out the, what do they put in diapers? Well, some synthetic, but it absorbs 50 times its weight in water. But it is a synthetic, so it doesn't work so good for gardening because you can't keep putting all the synthetic on the garden. So this is a good application. We've been working on automatic composites, trunk liners, trunk decking, floorboards, door panels. These are all made out of polypropylene polyester fiber blends that are hot pressed into the different shapes you see. And we've successfully been able to demonstrate and patent that you can use the coconut fiber as a replacement for the polyester. It'll save about 3 million barrels of oil per year. The total market is 300 million pounds per year. And we can make the coconut worth five times what it has been worth before. Interestingly enough, in fact, there's very little value for most of the coconut husks. They make them into twine and rope, but that's about the only market, and there isn't that much market for that. So every place I've been where there are lots of coconuts, there are huge stacks like this of husks that are simply thrown away. And so what we've been trying to do is to figure out how can we convert essentially trash into cash. This is actually a trunk liner part for a Chevrolet Malibu. And so we've been working through with an intermediary who is also a company with a very committed Christian president, who is already a supplier for four major automotive companies. And we already are in the process of getting certified to be able to replace all of their automotive composites with coconut fiber polypropylene. We are so excited. I've got two students who are finishing their master's degrees, just graduated, who are going to be the first two employees of a new company that we started called Whole Tree based on this technology. You can also use coconut fiber to make geotechnical netting. Here's a hillside in the Philippines where they have tremendous problems with erosion. You can take geotechnical netting, much like we use around overpasses, and in 1 year, that's what it looks like. So tremendous opportunities. Again, this is another really good application. A friend of ours has been doing this in the Philippines and has created jobs for 1,200 families who didn't have jobs before, just taking coconut husk and making it them planted. 150 of those were former organized communist terrorists, and 200 of them were former Islamic terrorists. And these were people who weren't terrorists because they were ideologically supporting the campaign. It was the only way they could support. Here's a good friend of ours from the seminary at Baylor who just graduated in December. He's going back to Ghana. He took this picture when he was there last summer. Ghana is a country where they have tremendous amounts of coconuts and they don't do very much with them. And he was so excited to find out what we were doing at Baylor. We've been meeting together for 6 months. He's going to go back. He was going to be a youth minister when he went back. And he said, you know, the best way I can minister to the youth in my country who have no possibility for jobs, no opportunity whatsoever, is to go back and start a company that will be based on processing coconuts into more value-added products. And we work with them to develop the technology and run business plans. And then to use that as a basis for doing the Christian ministry that he wants to do. How many coconut farmers, how many coconuts? Again, 50 billion per year are grown, 96% owned by poor coconut farmers. 10 million coconut farmers, actually it's closer to 11 now, 3.5 million just in the Philippines alone, typical family size, 6 to 8. Potential impact, 80 million people. Our goal is to be able to triple the income of as many of those families as possible. This is really exciting stuff. It's far more exciting than anything I've ever done making high-performance composites for the Air Force or NASA or doing some of the other things I've done, which have actually been pretty exciting stuff, but this is and make a huge impact. The second area we're working on is stoves, and why they're important. 600 million households cook with dry biomass every day in developing countries, generally over open fires. At 4 members per average household, that's about 2.4 billion people, and a third of the world's population cooks their meal every night over open fires. Campfire cooking, every meal, rain or shine, often done indoors, and you get situations like this. Extremely unhealthy. It's the fourth leading cause of health problems in the world, is cooking over open fires. In Nepal, they don't even name their children until they're 5 years old because the vast majority of them die and they don't want to be attacked. Now, often, why do they die? They mainly die because in Nepal it's cold, they have to cook indoors, they cook indoors with no ventilation over open fires, and it looks like that. Can you imagine? That's like smoking 10 packs of cigarettes a day. And then you have other accidents due to the kids being around the open fires inside the house, or the mother's rest as she turns around, they catch on fire. tremendous risk and danger having an open fire in your little house with your children playing around all the time. Environment is a huge problem too. If you think of the consumption when you cook over an open fire, it's extremely inefficient energetically. And so we're burning down the forest of the world because people who can't afford to buy propane or charcoal or other more expensive fuels will naturally use what they can go and scavenger for free. And so we're burning down a lot of the wood resources of the world because of these stuff. And then it's tremendous work. In many poor parts of the world, a woman may spend 5 to 6 hours a day scavengering enough wood to be able to cook dinner. And again, young girls are often not allowed to go to school because they have to go help their mother do this rather physically draining job of caring. Here's one of my graduate students who, in fact, is on a trip to Peru. They've just put in a stove, and these people look like people in the 1800s when they took pictures here. They all look real serious. You know, they're not smiling. I think they're very happy about their new stove. But they're looking very, you wouldn't guess it from the picture, right? If I look at pictures of people from our country back when they first started taking pictures, I felt like you had to look serious and dignified. Now, here's the project. We're working with Colorado State University on a project funded by Shell Foundation. And here's the goal. Energy-efficient, clean-burning, durable wood cook stoves for about $120 to $150 a year. The problem with this is these different requirements don't go together. Clean burning, energy efficient, means high temperature. High temperature means 900 degrees centigrade. That means real materials problems, and it means we need to have materials like you would use in a jet engine, except burning dirty fuel, and then expect it to last 5 years with lots of thermal cycling. You need to use materials at all. Can appreciate this is a very, very challenging problem. But if we can solve this problem, then in fact, you, the carbon credits that are being traded in Europe, you could actually get $120 worth of carbon credits for this. If the stove didn't cost more than $150, you could make it available for $20 to $30. And it would be a terrific improvement in quality of life for these people. So the stove might end up looking something like this. The combustion chamber that we're working on looks something like this. And the combustion chamber is the real problem here. We want this combustion chamber to be able to go to 900 degrees centigrade with cyclic environment 3 times per day during burning wood that has bark on it that makes it extremely corrosive. And all we need is something with a low heat capacity, low thermal conductivity, good erosion resistance, high temperature capacity, tolerance to corrosive alkaline environment, and that's essentially what we're working on. And we've come up with a good solution. I can't tell you what that is yet because it's in the process of being patented. But the solution, we think, will work well. It'll work in the price range we need. And Shell, before we started this project, said if we could come up with a solution that would meet those targets, they would prepare to invest $25 million to make production in 6 different countries of the world, widely distributed, to try to provide at least stoves for over time, 2 billion people. Okay? Immediately, they're going to try to produce 10 million in the first 5 years. So, again, really, it's exciting to be working on these things. And some of the problems are very challenging. The material science dimensions to this are required. All the usual things I've been doing over the years with scanning electron microscopy and EDAX energy spectroscopy and lots of what I think of as high tech. In fact, that it's appropriate technology doesn't mean the solution to the problem doesn't require good basic fundamental research. You can find projects that are research can be very publishable, the work can be very challenging, but the solution has to be something that's inexpensive, that is very easily maintained, and meets the different other requirements you might have. This is a group of students that went with me to Armenia for a third kind of project. This is a very common situation in Armenia. Armenia has a climate much like North Dakota. So in winter it gets down to 30 below zero, in the summer it gets up to about 110. You can stand the heat, but it's really hard to stand the cold. Many of these people are extremely poor, and they often live in what you see behind you here. This is actually a shipping container that was discarded when it more or less wore out. And poor people use shipping containers for their housing. Now, they recently moved into a different place. Before they did that, it had the roof pieces on. They've actually stripped a few pieces off and taken some of the metal and used it for something else. But can you imagine you're homing a shipping container that's metal when it's 30 degrees below zero outside. We have some friends who are in the ministry there who emailed us recently that one of the couples that they work with, who's a pastor of a very small church in India, one of their children simply froze to death this past winter, and that happens. And they were living in a house, not in a shipping container. But many, many children and some adults died because it would be below freezing inside the house almost every night. Okay. And what can you do? You can build a fire inside, but how good is that? Well, you trade one problem for another. So it's a very difficult situation. So here's the solution we came up with. In this case, it was a good engineering solution. You didn't have to start from scratch. You may have seen examples, there's about 20 different examples of people making concrete foam houses. And the question is, how does that work? Well, the blocks that are being laid look like this. Okay, they're 4 feet long, about a foot tall, and about 8 inches thick. They have 6 holes in them, and they look like giant Lego blocks. So you put rebar, slide the foam blocks over that. Once you get them all stacked, then you pour the columns, which are all lined up, because they're where the holes are, where these pieces are. And the net result is that you can make a house that on 6 inch centers has a 4.5 inch square concrete column with rebar in it, which is much stronger than 2x4s. It's more earthquake resistant, it's more wind resistant. You had houses like this in New Orleans when they had the Katrina debacle. None of them would have blown down, and if they had had water inside, you'd just let them dry out, and it would have been fine. Now, the nice thing about this is you can build a house like this in an afternoon. You can't pour the foundation and put in all the electrical and plumbing, but we could put up all the blocks and essentially put in rebar and essentially construct a house with no skilled labor in a very, very short period of time. The total cost for all the foam blocks for a house of 640 square feet, it ends up looking like this when it's finished, was about $2,000. And what's really cool about this house is the R value. In Armenia, the people who have money build houses with walls that are 30 inches thick. And I thought they must really be worried about security around here until I realized this is solid, two stone, 12 inches, 6 inches of concrete, 12 more inches of two stone, 30 inch thick wall. Do the thermal conductivity on this stuff, it really loses heat like a sieve. Our value is 5. If you know anything about building construction, minimum in the U.S. is 19. Okay? So even though it's a 30-inch thick wall that's very expensive to build, it still doesn't keep the heat inside the house. Our concrete foam houses have an R value of 30. So much, much better than what we're currently using, much, much cheaper, and it provides a way of providing housing for people that will be not only inexpensive to put in, put the house up, but it will also be very energy efficient. And when we first told people what they were doing, they said, styrofoam, that's really bad for the environment. It's not biodegradable. Does that make sense? If you're putting it in landfill, that's a valid argument. How about if you're trying to make a house out of it? Do you want it to be biodegradable? Would you buy a house that was biodegradable? One of the real virtues of this house is it's not biodegradable. Hallelujah. Now, we did put some plaster on the outside because it is susceptible to environmental degradation, and we didn't want it to look like a plastic house. I mean, even poor people have their dignity, right? They don't want to live in a house that looks like plastic. So we basically stuck with it, and it looks like a California contemporary house. I mean, it looks really nice. The people in Yerevan, the main city in Armenia, were so curious about what we were doing. We got on major television 2 nights in a row, where they came and took video and talked about what we were doing and so forth and so on. Because the idea of a house that's cheap and warm in a country where there's lots of poor people who freeze to death in the winter is an extremely interesting idea. What's happened since then, this was a year and a half ago, is some of the people that we're working with, the people we were partnering with, and one of the things I've learned when you're working to help alleviate poverty is everybody wants to partner and cooperate because there's a lot more poverty to go around than there's help, right? So nobody says, you can't have my poor people, I've got these, you've got those, you know. There's such an overwhelming need that everybody wants to work together and cooperate. But these are the people that we worked with, and George Fermanian has since started a nonprofit that's called Lutheran World Homes that is, in fact, now building homes of this type in Mexico, in Brazil, and in Armenia. We're producing all of the, and I'm on the board, we're producing all of the parts of the house in country, including the phone blocks. So we're creating jobs, keeping the cost as low as possible, and providing very, very warm and high quality housing for a large number of poor people. I think one of the things that can be done is to use this, sell these houses at market price for people who can afford it. You can make a good margin on it compared to the current housing that's been used, and then use some of those profits to then fund housing for poor people. So there's a lot of different ways to try to work this. A fourth example of a project that we've done at Baylor has to do with bridges. Now, in this country, we just take bridges for granted. You would never think about how are you going to get your product across the river, right? When we first started working on this, it seemed to me like this was a really strange problem. The people on the far side, you can see they're basically growing crops. To get their crops to market, had to go 10 miles down, cross at a different place, and come back. So they marched about 20 miles. The women always, unfortunately, get the worst end of this, it seems like, carrying a 35 pounds worth of produce on their backs every weekend, 20 miles to go to market, and then 20 miles to come back home. What a hard life. And I mean, I've seen ladies who couldn't weigh more than 100 pounds carrying that much weight. Kids can't go to school because they can't hike that far every day. And if you have a child with a medical emergency, you've got to literally carry them that distance. So the bridge that we built here basically cost $5,000. It will avoid 2 million miles a year worth of walking for about 10 years at least. So we figure, what's the cost per mile saved of that? And the answer is, it's really, really huge. Really low, I should say. The benefits are good. This bridge was built basically in 3 days. We worked with Bridging the Gap Africa. They wanted us to come and help do all of the analysis of this bridge because the guy who'd been building it was a builder from California who was doing missions in Africa. But he wasn't an engineer, so he asked, could we come and help build a bridge and then do all the analysis to be sure the safety factors are reasonable, not too high, but not too low. And so we did that. We had a wonderful time. It turns out that the people on the far side of the river were people who, the village chief was a Christian, the village vice chief was a Christian, and half the people in the village were Christian. They've been praying for years that God would somehow provide a bridge for them. And so we were able to come and say, we're here because God sent us to be an answer to your prayer. And so it was, again, a wonderful opportunity. When we're doing this, we're always partnering with people in country who are Christians, who already have a presence there. So what's done as part of a kingdom building, not just a humanitarian exercise. Now, they wanted us to help do a different bridge, and the bridge they wanted us to do was a 420-foot, a bridge that spans 420 feet. And this was, we found this bridge in Kentucky. We thought, well, that's about the right length. We could maybe do something like that. Problem is, this bridge costs $500,000, and it has all kinds of things in it that you can't buy in country. And so we wanted to try to build a bridge or design a bridge that could be built as much as possible with materials in country and at a price that was closer to $100,000 to $200,000. So it was really challenging to find out how can we do this and how can we do it safely. Here's the river. This is in the very, very low dry season. So you say, well, that don't look too bad. 420 feet wide. Why do you suppose these guys have guns and machetes? You might notice what they're carrying there. Why do you suppose they're carrying guns and machetes? There's an obvious answer to this question.
Alligators.
That's right. When we first were getting involved in this project, we got an email from Harmon saying a young mother who was trying to cross the river had 5 children, 1 2 weeks old, was eaten by a crocodile. And many people have that happen, so a lot of them simply don't try to cross the river even when the water levels are low, because it's too dangerous. The river has hippopotamuses and crocodiles. It's not safe. Okay? So they're there basically scoping the thing out. We have a big bridge in Texas, in Waco, that is like a enlarged pedestrian bridge that is 450 feet long. And I got to looking at that. It was built in 1869, and the question is, who would put up that kind of money, and how did they do it without power equipment? Because this bridge is 50 miles from the nearest road. One we're trying to build. So it's going to be hard to get anything there. It's going to be really hard to build in that location. But Irish missionaries have helped the people on the far side of this river with irrigation to make three crops a year instead of one. And now for the first time in their history, they have a surplus of food that they're growing and no way to get it to market. If they could get the surplus crops to market, the village could make about, 3,000 people, make about $150,000 a year. And the village has never made any money, ever, period. Okay? So what a neat opportunity. And basically we're working with helping the design of that bridge, and maybe the government also helped to build it. So this is a simple early schematic that I just threw in here to show you the design that we have in mind and how we're going to be trying to do the foundations and so forth. A couple of projects quickly, and we'll wrap up here. Some students from Baylor went, and before they went, they designed a water purification system for a deaf school run by Christians in Kenya. I might add the bridge project I just described was also in Kenya. They said it was so interesting to see the response of the children because they've been drinking muddy water all their lives. And when they first got water out of the purification system, they had put in, this village has no electricity, which is pretty common. A lot of places there. They did install a solar system. The solar system then is used to run a water purification system and also to run a small pump. And now the village, not the whole village, but the deaf school, and they will provide water for other people in the village to the extent that they're able to do that. Provides tremendous clean water resources for this village. And I said the kids were all astonished to be able to look through a glass and see the other side. They never drank water like that before. They always drank water that was just dirty brown. And they all thought it was so exciting to be able to have a glass of clean water. One of my friends who was on this project, and I just forgot to get a picture from him, has some really remarkable pictures of young children who were astonished that they didn't know water was could be clear. They thought water was brown, right? Because it's the only water they've ever seen. And here's a place in Nairobi. There is a slum there called Kibera Slum. It's actually a pretty famous place because about 900,000 people live in space about the size of Baylor University's campus. And it's probably the biggest shanty town in the world. It's minimal water, sewage, and so forth. And so they basically built a wind tower, also combined it with some solar to provide electricity for homes that were in the immediate vicinity of this part of the slum. And they worked with Christians who are part of the church there and are doing ministry in the slum to try to provide some low-cost electricity so people can have a light bulb at night and have just a little bit of light instead of trying to burn propane, which they can't afford, or burn kerosene lamps and making the place so polluted. Their idea here was to try to say if we can make this work, then we could actually have it spread and have lots of these in the Kibera slum. It would provide a source of cheap electricity and also create jobs and provide opportunities for people in the slum. So again, our goal is always to figure out, if we can, market-driven ways of solving these kinds of problems. What these people need is not just a handout. They need a hand up. They need an opportunity to be able to do something that will help them. Now, my colleague in electrical engineering who's still working on this is doing something equally exciting in Honduras. They're basically developing electricity for a lot of small villages that are being, in a sense, distributed through the different little churches there where they can put in micro hydro systems. Honduras is very mountainous and it has lots of rain. And that's all you need to do micro hydro. They put in micro hydro systems, build little water reserves, collect the water, and then they can sort of regulate its flow through the micro hydro and generate electricity. It reduces the cost to the people by about 70% of what they're paying now. It creates jobs. They're trying to do all the purchasing of stuff in country to create more economic opportunity there. And they've already done their first one, and it's working fine. It's actually paying off. People are paying for their electricity every month and doing as they should. One more demo project, they'll be ready to franchise this, and they have 400 churches they're working with there to provide exactly the same kind of micro hydro electricity. Now, what are the challenges with, and I want to pretend it's all as easy as I'm making it sound. It sounds like, well, you just go out and talk to something, and all of a sudden it all works out. You have a big contract with General Motors or Toyota or somebody. millions of dollars worth of stuff. It's not quite that easy. To me, the most difficult problem is identifying potential high-impact opportunities. Okay? That's the most challenging. Now, how do you do that? I don't think there's an easy way to do this short of trying to work closely with people in country, or better yet, go visit countries. One of the people who I have the greatest regard for, a fellow named Paul Pollock, who started an organization called IDE, he's interviewed personally 3,000 poor people in different parts of the world. And through his interviews, he tried to find out, what do they really need? Because, you know, sometimes we think we're so smart that we're Americans and we're Westerners and we have better standards of living and more education, so we know what these people need, and that's really very incorrect. If you go talk to the poor people, they can often tell you exactly what they need, and by doing that, he was able to identify drip irrigation systems could help them to have three crops a year instead of one, but the drip irrigation systems have to be super, super cheap, about one-tenth of what they were at that time. He spent 6 years working this, getting really cheap drip irrigation systems and simple ones, and then developing marketing and people to be selling and so forth and so on. And today, 17 million families have tripled their income because of that one development. Treadle pump and irrigation systems. So getting a good project is really, really important. And one of the best ways to do that, if you go to a missions trip to a developing part of the world, look around and see what are the natural resources and see what are the different opportunities, what are the things that are in great need. There are lots of interesting stories of how people have been able to develop terrific opportunities. I think the second challenge is research funding. Because the area that I'm working in now is not like working for NASA or the Air Force or DOE or some other people I've worked for in the past who pony up with $250,000 without blinking very hard. The money that we're getting now is more in units of $25,000 to $50,000. So we have to work extra hard to make that money go a bit further. But the impact of what we're doing is potentially very huge. And we're in the process of trying to lobby with our senators and representatives to say, we give billions and billions of dollars a year away, and a lot of it gets wasted. Why don't they spend a little bit of that investing in these kinds of R&D projects that could make a big difference? Kind of touching the bottom-up approach. But it can be done, and it can be done on a shoestring if necessary. Where to publish? Well, some problems fit, some don't. Obviously, the bridge building project we did isn't publishable. We're using standard technology. The project we did on cook stoves is very publishable because finding material that will do the things we need to do and demonstrating it really works with all the thermal cycling and studying the oxides and form and the resistance to the falling and thermal cycling. There's a lot of good hard science in that. So that one's actually very publishable. The automotive composites we've done, we already got a patent on it, and it will be publishable in good composites journals. So some are, some aren't. Finding high-quality graduate students whose life goals fit this. I think for some of the projects I'm doing, I've been fortunate because I've had students who came to me and said, I want to do this for my career. Do you have a project I could work on for a master's thesis? Well, safe bet. Students like that. They're getting a good, challenging master's project. I don't think any of these would work as PhD projects. But as master's projects, they work fine. And if there's students who want to do this, then it's a wonderful opportunity for them to get launched. And I'm hiring two of my own this past December for the new company that we're starting. May be necessary to pursue after the tenure process is successfully finished. Although this may make a big impact for poor people in developing parts of the world, not all universities recognize more than essentially one standard of what it takes to make tenure, and it has to do publishing in top journals and bring in X number of dollars of research. And so it may be that you have to delay a bit getting started on this. You begin dreaming on it immediately, and you can begin looking for interesting ideas right now. Or if you're in graduate school, like you graduate. But that's something you just need to think about, because although I think this is extremely valuable, I think it's more valuable than anything I've ever done in my career. On the other hand, that's not the value system of most universities and their tenure processes. And finally, let me simply say, there's a really interesting book by John Eldridge in which he gives an example of life as we prefer it. And he says we want a road to our future. It's nice and straight. It goes 200 miles down. And you can see the motel for the next night, you know, from the starting point. So there's no risk at all. So it's a nice, safe journey, but extraordinarily boring. There's another path, and it's normally the one God wants to take us on, in which it goes about 300 yards, and then it makes a sharp curve, and you don't know where it goes. And oftentimes, that's the road God wants us to go on, the one where it's a bit more risky, or the outcome is less defined, and yet where the possibilities, because we're in God's will, are far, far greater. And as you think about your own future, I would really encourage you to give some thought to how God might use you in this area. Maybe immediately, maybe eventually, maybe part-time, doing something on the side. I think that's up to you. But I think for all of us who are developing a background in technology, we have some unique opportunities. The things that I shared with you today, as I said, will be worth more than 1,000 times all the money I could ever possibly give to the college. If I wanted to be a big giver of money, I would work someplace besides a university, right? I've gone out in business and been a manager of president. So I better stop here. I've run too long. But thank you.
Any questions, thoughts? Yes.
I'd like to know more about how to find these opportunities. Could I go to a website with lists of some of these projects that you help?
You know, I think the answer is not yet. Okay? There are lots of organizations, though, that if you Google search appropriate technology, you'll find a lot of organizations that are doing this kind of stuff or trying to do it. Opportunity International, Helps International, Compassion International. A lot of these organizations are Christian organizations. Obviously, World Vision is another good one. But at this point, there's not a good central place to get that information. We're hoping to start a center at Baylor that would have a website that would provide that, also provide job opportunities, and do a lot of things that would match sort of people with problems. But that's not something that's in place yet.
Another opportunity to think of while you're in school is Engineers Without Borders.
Yes.
And so to get involved as master's students or PhD
students. Yep, we that's a very, very good example. And you can easily find them by just Google searching. I'm actually a member of Engineers Without Borders. Yes.
How do you deal with the power issues in those countries after you developed this technology, you created water there, then somebody has the thing that makes the clean water, or somebody has one end of the bridge. How do you deal with those power issues and disseminating those so you don't just form another set of power that prevents people from getting these things?
You know, we're partnering in every case with people there. And so we're really depending on them. There's no way I can do that for them. So, but in almost every case, the people we're working with have been there 10 years, they know all the problems of corruption, you make something nice and the government steals it, or maybe somebody else steals it. You know, when we were building the house in Armenia, we actually had to put all of our building materials in a protective shed and had 2 guards. Because overnight, if there was one night it hadn't been guarded and locked up, it would all disappear. You know, those are extra costs I hadn't even thought of, but the people who are working said, oh yeah, we're not going to be able to build this if we don't do that. At the bridge, out in the middle of nowhere, 3 miles from the nearest road that we built, they actually had people from the village they paid to be night watchmen. Because people would come and steal all the stuff we were going to build the bridge with, and then when we screwed nuts on the bridge to put the planks on, we booted up all of the bolts. So that they couldn't take them off because they would come and steal the nuts and bolts and the wood off of the bridge. You know, I mean, these are very real problems. I wouldn't have thought of these things. But the people there said, oh yeah, you know, when you get finished with each bolt, be sure and, you know, take your pliers and screw up the threads really good so nobody can take it off. Yeah. So it's a very real problem, but it's one we have to trust the people there to do the best they can, but there's no foolproof way to do that. Yes.
The person who interviewed the board, does he have like a study or a book on, you know, all the people he interviewed?
Paul Pollan?
Yeah.
Yeah, go to Google, sir. Go to Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Paul Pollak, P-O-L-A-K. And I think the title of his book is What to Do in All the Traditional Approaches. And the book has been published within the last year. And he's really smart. You know, in engineering, we always say when you're developing new products, what's the first order of business? Talk to your customer, right? Find out what the customer really wants, really needs, and how you can meet that need. Now, he doesn't know how to solve his problem, but he knows what his problem is very well. And so I think that's what Paul was so good at, why he's the most successful person in doing this. You know what his background is? Psychiatry. I said, Paul, how could a guy who's in psychiatry do this so well? And he said, well, you know, psychiatrists know how to listen. I mean, that's our main job, right? We talk to people and we listen. He said, being trained in listening is actually more useful than being trained in engineering for what we're doing. I thought, you know, there's a lot of wisdom in that.
Or at least maybe we should work with them.
Yeah.
Yes.
How do you decide when it's appropriate or desirable to patent something in the work?
My opinion is it's always appropriate to patent anything you can patent. Yeah. Why? Because I want to control how the technology gets used. I may give it away. The reason we're worried about this is I want to be able to buy fibers, coconut fibers, or I want to pay 40 cents a pound for them. But the current market value is 8 cents a pound. Now, how can I sustain that price? If I have a patent, I license the technology to companies and say, you've got to buy the fibers for me. That's one of the conditions of the licensing agreement. And the price is whatever it happens to be. Okay? So I can have a tremendous impact. If I didn't do that, then I would develop clever things, hopefully, and other people would come in and sell for 10 cents a pound. And all that margin that I want to give to the people there can't be sustained. So that's why I'm saying I think it's too...
Why doesn't your university own the patent? How do they let you...
Oh, the university will own the patent. We're the exclusive licensee. Yeah, Beta will own the patents that we're developing. We're the exclusive licensee. We'll pay them a small royalty. Okay? They're very supportive of what we're doing in this project, so they're going to make the royalty very reasonable. Then there is still enough margin to be able to make it very, very attractive to the people we're trying to help while still making business sustainable on this end and cutting the price on the all these synthetic fibers that they're using now.
My university would be very interested in making as much money as they could possibly make.
Which university do you work for?
You already know that.
Okay. I don't think you say. Okay. Now, you know, I think Baylor obviously is interested in getting a good return on the royalty as well. But I think that most of the things that are licensed are probably 3-6%. So if you have an idea that has a margin in it, then you can afford that. Okay? They'll put us on the low end of that, I hope. We haven't signed the licensing agreement yet. But I know they are very excited about what we're trying to do, and I think they'll be reasonable with us. But if, when I was at A&M, they would have licensed it. Dennis, what are they licensed for? 3-6% royalty?
Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's a cost we're willing to pay.
I mean, you're being benevolent in trying to help with folks that I would be scared that anybody else with control over would be trying to make a lot.
Well, at this point, I think most schools, if you're the one who developed the patent, they will want to recover their costs and some money beyond that. But they almost always give you the first rights of refusal on exclusive use of it. Okay.
Other questions? Yes?
I'm really interested in touching that idea, and as you increase the value of that commodity, are there any unintended consequences? For example, products that the poor people buy that are based on coconuts, and then the cost of the products is increased?
You know, the main thing that they almost don't use any of it for anything. We have some really good ideas on how to use the shell as well, and that's mostly a throwaway item too. Okay. So the main thing they use it for in country is coconut oil. Okay, there is a good market in the United States with a better price point for that, but we're not looking at that right now. We have one place in Indonesia that makes coconut milk, which is the water oil mixed together as it comes out of the coconut. They generate 500,000 coconut husks per day. And they're all throwaways. So we think there's a huge, you know, our first order of business is to take all the free trash and turn it into cash, and then we'll later worry about some of this other stuff, okay? Yeah.
Is there any concern that once you get through all the trash that
farmers will just start cutting off the coconuts and sending them whole to you and not allowing the food to be taken out of them for the surrounding people.
Well, we're not going to be willing to pay that high a price. Okay, right now, coconut husks typically bring a half a cent a piece if they can find anybody to buy them. But the coconut's worth about 10 cents.
Okay, so well
yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So what we'll want to do is to set up our milling operations right next door to an oil production plant and say, well, we want to buy your coconut husk. Or we'll tell the farmer to say, tell them they get the nut, we get the husk, and we'll pay them 4 cents for it maybe, or 5 cents for it instead of half a cent. And then we'll also create jobs, and we're going to do all the in-country processing we possibly can before it's shipped. So again, the idea is do value added there, create jobs, and in every case we're working with really need committed Christians. The guy who we're working with in Indonesia is a very, very successful businessman who actually wants to quit what he's now doing and make this his main thing because he wants to do this in parts of the country that are primarily Islamic. And he said the way to go in there and to really try to start a church is to not go in knocking on doors with tracts. That gets you in a lot of trouble. It's to go set up a business and hire a lot of desperately poor people and treat them well and pay more than what the market demands for husk and so forth. And you'll be able to lay a platform from which I think the gospel will make a lot of sense.
So one last comment.
Jack? Is there such a thing or such a worry as sustainable coconut farming? Are they hardened soils, especially if you start producing them commercially and harvesting every year?
No, they're not hardened soils at all. In fact, most of the coconut trees will produce fruit for about 70 years, and that's often with no fertilization whatsoever.
Where do they get their raw materials, their carbon and their nitrogen?
Well, the carbon, obviously, they get from carbon dioxide, okay? I don't know where the nitrogen comes from, but what happens over time is the amount of fruit produced per year will typically gradually go down. These are often near the coast, okay? And it's thought that at least some of that comes from, they lack a little bit of salt water, and there are nutrients also in the salt water that may help with that. But you can double the production by doing some simple fertilization. And so you're right, they don't die just because you haven't been fertilized, but they don't produce as well. And those are things that we're learning about so that we can help the people there to produce as big a crop as possible and in a sustainable way.
So currently you're examining all the dimensions?
Oh, absolutely. We're worried about every different part of it. And I don't know about all this stuff, but I've got good friends in agriculture at A&M, and I've got people in the business school helping with the business plans. And, so this is not a one-man show. Nobody can know all this stuff. But you can network and get a bunch of people together who think they'd really love to help. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Well, I'm going to cut you free because it's 5 after 5, and I know it's been a long afternoon, so we've all learned more about coconut than we ever thought we could. So thank you, Walter. And all speakers will still be around. Dave Gill will be around afterwards. If you want to chat more, be more than welcome. And happy